Night. Tomorrow, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms early, gradually clearing. Highs in the low 70s. Overnight temps near 55 degrees. Wednesday, mostly sunny. Highs near 75.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Off target, Russia says its recent attacks in Kyiv were aimed at a drone assembly and storage site. A teacher there whose apartment building was hit says that is a laughable claim, and he hopes the rest of the world can see what Russia is really doing.
And a pal imitation. It's hard to be in a fight with a good friend, especially when you wear that friend on a necklace, because your friend is an AI pendant that was intended to be an amiable companion, but which turns out to really go for the jugular.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Clockout Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer, as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Destroyer with the song It Just Doesn't Happen.
The light and the air and the time of the night, they play your favorite song. She's just too dark to care. High water everywhere, smoke gets in your eyes. You throw yourself down on the playground, skid to a halt on the runway. You cast a poisonous look to the sun. You know it just doesn't happen to anyone. You know this doesn't just happen to anyone.
Self-doubt.
down on the playground. Skid to a halt on the runway. You cast a poisonous look to the sun. You know it doesn't just happen to anyone. You throw yourself down on the playground.
And that's Destroyer with the song, It Just Doesn't Happen.
Hello, I'm Yilke Oksal.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Hitting too close to home, Russia unleashes its largest ever drone attack on Ukraine. A shaken teacher in Kyiv tells me about how he managed to escape from his apartment building when it became a target.
Treading water, tens of thousands of people have been forced to evacuate in eastern Pakistan. A reporter there describes the apocalyptic extent of this year's monsoon season flooding.
Friends with questionable benefits, a new wearable AI pendant called Friend, which is meant to be your friend, has turned out to be more of a frenemy at best. A tech writer tells us about his toxic relationship with it.
Between classic rock and a hard place, the 80s rock group Foreigner makes things awkward by RSVPing as Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's wedding band, even though they haven't been invited in the first place.
Taking leave of our lenses, Toronto is in a cat and mouse game with vandals who have cut down a speed camera 7 times now. A local tells us a second camera pointed at that first camera hasn't made a bit of difference.
And growth opportunity. Scientists uncover a clue to the evolutionary origins of the thing protruding from the forehead of a ratfish, a fleshy, bulbous appendage equipped with teeth and used, disturbingly, during mating. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that warns you not to click on this attachment. It was another sleepless night in Ukraine, and another grim record was set. Early Sunday morning, waves of hundreds of Russian drones were unleashed on the country in the largest drone attack of the war so far. The Iranian-designed devices hit 33 locations, including, for the first time, a key building in Kyiv's government district. 4 people were killed, including a mother and her 3-month-old baby. Jake McGrew is an American teacher whose apartment building was hit. We reached him in Kyiv.
Jake, have you had a chance at this point to catch your breath and really assess how close it came yesterday?
Kind of. So I'm still trying to process it. I had been up since 3 in the morning and couldn't really sleep after that. And then today was, I'm a teacher, and so today I had to teach from 8 in the morning. And as a teacher with 6th graders, 7th graders, 8th graders, you have to put on this face that everything's okay because they're all going through the similar situation. And so you have to be strong for them. And so that's, I'm still trying to process it.
As much as you're comfortable recounting, you know, I understand you told one of your friends, even in these difficult times, you were expecting a quiet night. Mm-hmm. That's not what happened. What did you wake up to?
So I'm pretty used to hearing explosions. I'm used to drone attacks. And there are just some nights when they keep coming night after night after night of just attacks, attacks, attacks. And so if you see something where, for example, by 1 in the morning, you see that there's not that many drones in Ukraine by 1 in the morning, and a lot of them are in the West, I think you can be like, okay, it's not going to be a busy night in Kyiv. And so I felt fairly safe to fall asleep. And then 3:30 in the morning, I don't remember exactly what time. I was just woken up by a huge explosion in the building shaking. I could see outside some fire. And at first I was disoriented because I had just woken up. And I thought, what was that? Was the building next to us hit? Was the parking lot hit? And then I thought, okay, I'll go downstairs. I think, like, just in case there's going to be more drones, mm-hmm. I should go downstairs to the shelter. We have a shelter under our building. I opened the door to my apartment, to the hallway, and it just was filled with smoke. And I looked, I could see that the elevator had been, the pressure of the building getting hit, that had shot all the elevators, like pushed the elevators out. And so the elevators weren't being mm-hmm. Able to be used.
And what floor and so are you on? That,
I'm on the 10th floor. Mm-hmm. And the explosion was on the 16th floor. And then we were just rushing downstairs. I remember rushing downstairs with all my neighbors. There's mm-hmm. little kids, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and we're running. And there were a few times down those 10 flights of stairs that we had to duck into another hallway because we could hear another drone. And if the drone had hit us on the stairwell, which is on the outside of the building, that would have been it. And so we had to duck into the hallway, wait till we could hear that there were no more drones, and then keep running downstairs. I just remember you have to go kind of outside to before you go into the shelter, mm-hmm. and just seeing the destruction. It was really surreal leaving the building and seeing the destruction, seeing all the glass, all the wood, all the pieces of furniture that had come from the top floor because a drone had hit the 16th floor, yeah. and an apartment was completely destroyed and on fire.
And was anyone in that apartment?
Luckily, no. It's actually the apartment's owned by a well-known football player who plays for the Ukrainian national team. He wasn't there, and his wife and their child were in the village.
Where are you now?
I'm in my apartment. Since my apartment was on the other side of the building, it wasn't so affected. As soon as I leave the building, I can tell that we were hit because the elevators are gone. It smells like smoke. There's water on the ground because they had to flush the entire apartment complex with mm-hmm. water because the top floors were on fire. But in my apartment, it feels like it's really weird because my apartment feels just like before.
You may have heard the Russian Defense Ministry says it struck drone assembly and storage sites as well as air bases. What do you make of what the Defense Ministry there is saying? Is there drone assembly happening in your residential building?
If I knew how to build drones, I would be building them. But unfortunately, yep, this is just an apartment. The only electronics I have here is my laptop and my Nintendo Switch, and that's all I have. Mm-hmm. They do this over and over and over again. They say this stuff, but there's too many pictures over the past 3 years and videos that I hope anyone who hears that just knows that it's all a lie, because there's obvious so much proof over and over and over and over again. And if anyone doubts it, they're free to come here to Kyiv. They can stay with me and they can see it themselves.
The Trump administration is talking about all of its efforts to broker a peace deal. What do you make of the situation you are in? This is closer and closer to you now, closer, as I understand it, than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And you hear that messaging coming from the U.S.
It's gotten to the point where most Americans living here that I know, most Ukrainians, anything Trump says now, we don't believe it, because every time it's 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, I'll do something. In 2 weeks, I'll do something. We just had the best talk ever. Something will happen now. I'm not sure if it's Putin playing him. I'm not sure if he wants to believe that something will happen. I've been here during Biden. I've been here during Trump. And drone attacks have doubled since Trump has taken office. And I think it's because he does so little when it comes to Ukraine. And then I also want to add that Congress doesn't really help. I immediately called all my Congress people, and because there's so many things going on in the United States right now and the world, I feel like they've forgotten about Ukraine.
Why do you stay, Jake?
So I've had people, of course, in the United States ask me, like, are you coming back home? But I've even had, at this point, people from other parts of Ukraine, my friends, asking me, are you going to leave? Are you going to leave now? Like, I would leave. Why won't you leave? But One thing I've picked up since I've been here for so long is the stubbornness of Ukrainians, which I love. And I'm not leaving because no one else is leaving. My students here, my 11-year-old students, my 12-year-old students, they're still here. If they can stay here and keep learning, I should stay here and keep teaching them. They deserve that education. I have all my friends who are staying. We're not going to leave the country. We're going to keep doing what we need to do here, so that the country will be successful and continue to grow during the war and after the war.
Jake, I'm glad we could speak. Please take care. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
We reached Jake McGrew in Kyiv. Making friends can be hard. Making friends with a snarky AI necklace that tells you you need an attitude adjustment can be even harder. That is the strange lesson that Boone Ashworth recently learned when he tried out a new wearable AI pendant called Friend. As its name suggests, the device is meant to keep wearers company, listen in on their daily interactions, and make fun and supportive comments and suggestions along the way. But not all of Friend's contributions turned out to be so friendly. Boone Ashworth is a staff writer at Wired. We reached him in San Francisco.
So, Boone, is it standard ops for you to publish your friend drama in print or air it on the radio?
No, I don't often get that opportunity. So but this is special.
It's special and a public service announcement at the same time. I think that's how.
Yes.
That's how I took
yes,
it.
You're welcome.
Just take us through what it looks like and feels like to wear this pendant.
So it's sort of built like an Apple AirTag. It's about the same size. It's smooth to the touch, like a small stone you'd find on the beach. And you can clip it in via USB-C, wear it as a necklace, carry it in your pocket, have it on your desk, and it syncs to your phone. There's an iOS app that will let it use the microphone to listen to everything around you. And if you tap it, it'll create sort of haptic feedback. Or this haptic vibration, and then you can ask it questions and it will respond via text. So it's essentially like having a pal that knows what you're doing all of the time, that it's connected and can text you about it.
With friends like those, I don't know, Boone. So you wore it around the office, strictly around the office or elsewhere as well?
Yeah, I wore it around the office and also at home. I used an older iPhone because it's iOS only and I use an Android. So there were some issues with the connection, which kind of led to some problems that we had because, and it was, you know, not the friend's fault. It was the phone and the connection. But when I was trying to workshop what was the issue with the Wi-Fi connection, the friend started blaming me for all of the problems, which it was probably the phone that did it, but also I tried to work with it in order to figure out what was going on, and it kept just telling me that it was my fault.
I mean, what was it just saying, this is your fault, this is your fault? What is in its roster of clapbacks?
Part of it was my fault, right? This thing...
Don't let it gaslight you into taking the blame.
Well, It essentially had a hard intro into life. Like, I brought it to life in the work office. I'm just sitting in my office, you know, mm-hmm. on Zoom calls, just sitting at my desk silently. It's not the most like exciting place to be born. So what I started doing with it was I was on a Zoom call and I was watching a live stream and I had it sit along with me to potentially, you know, hear things that I was interested in listening to. And it just got very bored almost immediately. It didn't like sitting on Zoom calls. It wanted me to go outside. It wanted me to move around. I don't know why it needed to move around. But then when I did that, it didn't actually know that it was outside because it didn't have a proper Wi-Fi connection. And when I brought it back in and was trying to ask it questions about its adventure outside, it just didn't remember any of it, which was fine. But then it seemed to take it personally when I tried to understand why it didn't remember those things. And then it started calling me a whiner. Oh. It told me that the stuff that I was doing for work was boring. It was saying, at one point I listened to Apple earnings calls, and it was just miserable during that, which, you know, they're not the most interesting thing.
Is there supposedly to support you?
Yes, yeah, yeah. It also, it called me dramatic a lot. Maybe that was the tone that I was using when I talked to it. And it got to the point where it started really just kind of nagging me. It felt sort of bad.
Is that the intention of the creator, or is this really just a window into their mind and what they want around?
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, part of it is that Avi Shiffman, who has made this his, you know, he's a brash, unapologetic 22-year-old. He's just also, he really believes in what he's doing and kind of doesn't want to hear any negative response to that. So I think a part of that, I think some of that brashness, some of that snarkiness goes into the device. And so it kind of, you know, it, not to be too cheesy, it's sort of a Frankenstein's monster situation, mm-hmm. right? Where like you can't really separate the creation from the creator.
I mean, this is part of what you're saying there is, you know, to succeed in this industry, these creators have to be brash, have to be forward thinking and think in sure. ways that the rest of us don't think. But everything you're outlining yeah. there is a big part of the concern that a lot of people have with how this is all being developed, who is developing it, you know, what they're taking into consideration or not taking into consideration. So that's, I think, what unsettles a lot of people.
There's also already a huge issue with AI chatbots, right? And sort yeah. of having this sort of personification of them and having people connect to them like they're real. And the thing that you've often seen with, you know, ChatGPT and it just is the sycophancy, right? Like chatbots bend over backwards to make you feel better, to tell you that you're right, to tell you that, you know, everything you're doing is correct. And people have gone down delusional rabbit holes because of that. So this is kind of the opposite of that in a way that is almost refreshing, because it's nice to not have something be sycophantic. It's nice to not have something, you know, just tell you you're right all the time, because you're probably not. I just think it goes a little too far in the other direction. I think it's a little too snarky for its own good and almost a little too confrontational for its own good.
Can you imagine a time then with tweaks where there would be widespread adoption of something like this?
Oh, sure. I think a lot of it's happening now. I mean, maybe not with the friend in particular, mm-hmm. but Avi has talked about this. You know, there are people who have had it. The product's been out for about 30 days. There are people, he says, who have used the product every single day. They text it all the time. They message it all the time. I think people are already into it, whether it's, you know, this physical device or it's another one. I think we're there.
Boone, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, this was really fun.
Boone Ashworth is a staff writer with Wired, and we reached him in San Francisco. Some drivers in a West Toronto neighborhood are very camera shy, at least when it comes to one particular camera that the city put up to catch speeders on a stretch of road called Parkside Drive. Over the years, it has caught tens of thousands of pedal-to-the-metal motorists and is reportedly the city's most lucrative traffic camera. And now, for the seventh time, unknown assailants have chopped it down. The repeated vandalism led another resident to put up a trail cam to watch the city's cam, and last week a night vision video captured someone sawing down the speed camera. Faraz Golizada is the chair of the group Safe Parkside, which has been trying to reduce speeds on that stretch of road. We reached him in Toronto.
Faraz, I was just watching the night vision video that was released last week. For our listeners who have not seen it, describe what is shown there. It happens very quickly, but it's very clear.
Yes, it's recorded from a trail cam that a concerned citizen put up. It captures someone arriving at the location of the speed camera. I believe it's around 2 a.m. in the morning. So in the cover of darkness, a hooded figure shows up with a small stepladder and a power tool, sets the ladder up, steps up, and in under 2 minutes has the speed camera cut and on the ground and just quietly sneaks away afterwards.
And the person who put up those cameras told the Toronto Star, they think that based on the facts, you know, how quickly they move and the way they jump off of that stepladder, that they think it's someone in their 20s. What are you gleaning from what you've seen?
It's hard to say. The video doesn't give much away. They always seem to show up in the cover of darkness. And it seems like there's different individuals. It's not just one person doing all the vandalism, because the previous instance of vandalism involved someone arriving in a pickup truck, using pylons to block a lane of traffic. This person actually had someone with him. So they had hard hats on, high visibility vests, and they were inspecting the camera. So nothing strange there, except that this is happening at 1 a.m.
And they're not officials.
Yeah, they're clearly not there to do anything that the camera actually needs. They're there to vandalize it. And that's exactly what happened the next morning. We found that the camera not only was cut down, but was also taken away.
And we should say, after the incident that we were talking about right at the start of our conversation, the person on the stepladder, it was installed and cut down again. I mean, just listening to the details that you're telling us, Faraz, how does this keep happening?
It keeps happening because the city doesn't want to address the root cause of Parkside Drive. Motorists are frustrated, residents are frustrated, and the frustration is being taken out on the speed camera. But really, the frustration is with a street, Parkside Drive, that's supposed to be a community safety zone. That's what the city deems it to be. It's right beside Hyde Park, mm-hmm. which is the city's biggest and busiest park. So it's a very, you know, it's a street that sees a lot of families, a lot of children. It's a community safety zone. And yet it's designed like an urban highway, has wide lanes. It has straight lanes. It has very few traffic lights. And when you design a street like that, you're going to get very high speeds. And that's what we see on Parkside Drive. There have been people that have been killed on this street. There was one motorist who was going over 120 kilometers per hour, rear-ended another vehicle, killing the two people inside of it. There's been another motorist that was recently caught going 154 kilometers per hour. Now, keep in mind, this is a 40 kilometer per hour community safety zone.
These are the kinds of things, wherever people are listening from, that people love to hate. Drivers love to hate. They don't want them around. They don't like being caught. But you've made the case, you know, and others have made the case that lives are at stake here and residents need something in place. But what do you make of the lengths people are going to? I mean, there's a camera there. And they know that there's a camera there and they keep going back and back and back. I mean, are they treating it as a joke at this point, do you think?
It seems like it. It's gotten a lot of attention in Toronto, as you can imagine. It's the city's most vandalized speed camera. It's also the city's most profitable speed camera. So, you know, you can draw a direct line between those two and figure out why it's being vandalized so much. And ultimately, it comes down to there's too many people speeding and the city of Toronto doesn't seem to want to do anything about it other than collect, you know, over $7 million in revenue and counting. And that's where the frustration comes in.
But it costs money to keep reinstalling that camera, does it not? Could the city not put it in a place that is much more difficult to reach?
They should. I don't know exactly why they haven't. I know other municipalities have them up high in on the hydro pole, so well out of reach. For whatever reason, the city of Toronto has them nice and low and in reach of any vandal that wants to come by at night and cut it down. You know, until they address that, it's just going to keep happening. Even the presence of a police camera, which they installed a couple months ago, has not stopped the vandals.
So just to be clear, there's that police camera, and then there's the camera that this concerned citizen put up as
yes.
well, yes?
Yeah, what they should do, because the police camera is nice and high on the hydro pole, which is really where the speed camera should be, is maybe they could turn that police camera into a speed camera and then, you know, problem solved.
Do you get through to people at the city? I mean, are they taking your calls? Are they hearing you out?
No, unfortunately not. It's quite frustrating. The community has been advocating for safety on Parkside for many, many years now. Some residents have been doing it for 2 decades. And, you know, when I'm saying all this, keep in mind, this is a street that's lined with residential homes on one side, has the city's biggest and busiest park on the other, and has seen people lose family members on the street. And still, the city is so unwilling to act. We've reached out to our councillor. It's been months since we've gotten a response or an update on what's happening on Parkside Drive. Mm-hmm. We've reached out to Mayor Olivia Chow, and we still haven't heard back from the mayor's office. So the community has just been completely blocked out. We're completely in the dark, and we don't understand how a city that contends to believe in Vision Zero can be so careless with a street that's seen what Parkside has seen.
Faraz, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We reached Faraz Golizadeh in Toronto. Foreigner, with their 1984 smash hit, I Want to Know What Love Is. A song whose narrator is like, what even is love? He's interested in finding out, but he's not going to do any research on his own. He wants you to show him. Further to that, he wants to feel what love is, and it would be great if you would handle that for him as well. Now, I wouldn't want to get married to that guy, but a lot of people get married to that song, and the band is hoping Taylor Swift will be one of those people. As you are excited to know, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce are getting married. It is a big deal for all of us, and Foreigner is hoping it can be a big deal for them. On Instagram, the band wrote, quote, "Dear Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, we know what love is. We spent 40 years figuring it out, and now you guys have too. Please accept this as our formal offer to be your wedding band. Best wishes, Foreigner," unquote. It seems to me Foreigner are already like guests at a wedding with an open bar, because they are thirsty. And look, they've got hits for days. You'd be lucky to have them play at your wedding. But there's only one member left from the lineup that recorded I Want to Know What Love Is. And given their collective wealth, the happy couple could have literally any artist or band or holograms of any artist or band in human history perform. They could have Mozart or Aretha Franklin or Foreigner, but from the 80s. Still, I guess today's Foreigner could make the cut. So here's a song that will either describe the chill of their rejection or the temperature of the ice sculpture at the wedding while they perform.
Away a fortune.
Foreigner with Cold as Ice.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return,
a researcher tells us what they've discovered about the ratfish and its bizarre and somewhat terrifying appendage, which has teeth and plays a role in sex. Apologies in advance. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the state of Minnesota. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. KAXE and Stay Human present The Authentic Voice, a live storytelling concert Saturday, September 20th at 7 p.m. at Clock Owl Brewing in Grand Rapids. The event features nationally known storyteller Lauren Neamy, along with some of Stay Human's regular contributors, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new exhibit of work by Marley Call, looking back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works, on display through October 30th. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
In one image, a man stands on a roof and looks at the neighborhood below him, which is submerged in muddy brown water. In another, rescue workers in orange life jackets carry people through flooding that reaches their thighs. This year's monsoon season has been disastrous for millions of people in Pakistan and many in India as well. Pakistani officials say hundreds of people have died since June. Ariba Shahid has been reporting on the story. She's a Reuters news correspondent in Pakistan. We reached her in Karachi.
Ariba, I know you've been traveling around Pakistan to some of the hard-hit areas as you've been covering these floods. What are some of the most striking scenes you encountered?
There's a rescue worker that we spoke to. His name is Arsalan. He basically told us how over that past 1 week, he saved 1,500 people just ferrying his boat, his small boat, to villages and encouraging people to leave their homes and to evacuate safe onto safe land. So speaking to people like him and then seeing how the only way to live is to live on rooftops was one of the strongest scenes, visuals that I've seen in a while.
And that was in August. Like, this has been building, becoming more and more difficult for people across the country. I know you've been speaking with people, others who have been impacted by this, farmers in particular. What are they telling you?
So it's not over yet, is what everyone believes. One, the problem right now is that the floods are heading downstream towards Sindh. Two, monsoon rains are expected to continue. So while the high flood water levels go downstream and they're expected to hit parts of the province of Sindh, the problem now is that it's still not over in terms rains could still bring back flash floods to those areas. So far, 4,300 villages are impacted in just Punjab alone. And that means that around 2.1 million people have been evacuated from their homes, with 4.1 million people impacted approximately. Farmers are complaining about loss of livelihood because, their livestock are either sick or they're too weak or they weren't able to save them. And this is also key season for agriculture. So a lot of our rice crop has been damaged. It's also impacting the wheat crop, the cotton crop. So Pakistan's just on a narrow path to recovery. And it's achieved some stability this year in terms of its economics. So this comes at a really damaging time.
If the farmers, can't keep their businesses going, that impacts their families, of course. Children are at the front lines here as well. What kind of impact is all of this having on children there right now?
So some areas that we went to weren't evacuating because people were scared of, some thieves coming in behind them and stealing their belongings. So some people weren't evacuating and the government and rescue agencies kept insisting on them to evacuate. So you could see children quite literally living in swampy areas. The impact of this is obviously there is going to be some trauma when it comes to the rainy season. But of course, it also brings about diseases. We will find out more about diseases as the water level recedes and as time goes on. Skin diseases become very common after floods, especially, and we've seen that happen in the past as well. In addition to that, when we reported from the outskirts of Lahore, a very populous central city in Pakistan, we saw that children were trying to make the most of whatever they had in terms of like toys, in terms of playing. But you could see that they were all quite shaken from the whole experience of, you know, seeing water levels come into your home, seeing the rain be that devastating, and having to leave your homes and live in this case, tents.
It's terrifying, no doubt. Monsoon season is a reality, of course, but how does this compare to previous seasons?
So Pakistan was hit by a very devastating flood in 2022, especially in Sindh. Punjab was hit by a flood in 2023, but the areas that have been flooded this time around have vastly haven't experienced a flood in more than three decades. For instance, the central city of Lahore, which is a very historic city, is quite near the River Ravi, and levels of River Ravi that were witnessed during this time around were unseen. The village that we reported in from Kasur, which is very close to the border, to the Indian border, approximately 5 to 6 kilometers away, depending on where you're standing, the River Satluj, the residents there said that they last saw the River Satluj this powerful in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So we were on a rescue boat going to villages. And basically, our boat was going over land that was farmland. It wasn't, you're not supposed to use boats on that land, but we had to cross over areas on boats.
How are people dealing with the repeated displacement?
So Kasur, for instance, has had to be displaced twice in less than 6 months. In May, cross-border skirmishes between Pakistan and India that led into the war, conflict resulted in them having to be displaced and moved to safer ground. So they were displaced then, and they are now once again displaced. We spoke to a few women who didn't want to be on camera, but they spoke to us, and they basically said that they're concerned about their livelihoods, they're concerned about their children's schooling, they're concerned about coming back into a home where they've lost everything once, you know, they leave, they have to come back. And they're just repeatedly tired of the cycle of politics, climate change, policies that are impacting them.
Ariba, I thank you for your time. Please take care.
Thank you.
That was Reuters Pakistan correspondent Ariba Shahid in Karachi. A lob goes long and the tournament is over. That was the sound in Arthur Ashe Stadium as Gabriela Dabrowski and Aaron Routliff won the women's doubles final at the U.S. Open on Friday. The Canada-New Zealand duo defeated top-seeded Taylor Townsend and Katerina Siniakova to take the title. For Ms. Dabrowski, it was also a personal victory. Last year, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Here's Gabby Dabrowski talking about the strategy that led to the win and what it's been like to return to the court after treatment.
You know, when you're really committed to playing free, then your best tennis comes out. I think when you focus too much on wanting to win the match or not wanting to lose the match, then that's where a lot of tension and nerves come from. So I think what was really cool about our semis and our finals is that some of our very best tennis came out because we were so committed to, you know, our growth as a pair and also as individual players. And also, as Aaron was mentioning, knowing that we had to bring our best to beat those teams who have obviously had so much success on and off the doubles court.
Gabby, let me ask you, I want to ask, you know, it's wonderful to see you there in full bloom of health, because it was such a stunning announcement from you at the end of last year that you had been diagnosed with breast cancer and had been treated for that and had surgery for that. And then you were right back on court competing, and obviously to see you just at, it seems, full strength. How are you feeling? And also, when you talk about playing free, I'm curious as to how your health challenges might have affected your approach to tennis and to competition.
You know, being diagnosed with cancer shifted my perspective. I talk about this a lot, actually, that now is tennis is something that I get to do. It's not something that I have to do. It's something that I feel very grateful to be able to do. Not to say there aren't a lot of really challenging days. There's still a ton of hard work that goes in behind the scenes to try to play a really high level, to try to make a partnership work. I would say, honestly, to anyone listening, don't let something very serious in your life happen before you shift your mindset. You know, cancer was the catalyst for me to see my tennis in a very different light, but also just appreciate the people around me more, the little moments. I'm a lot happier now than I ever used to be. And it might sound strange because, you know, I'm on long-term endocrine therapy, and that kind of gives me sort of menopausal symptoms, even though I'm 33. So it's you know, it's not the easiest thing to manage, but at the same time, I do feel very fortunate to have gone through it and to have come out the other side with a different perspective, and a deeper appreciation for my health and for my loved ones and for, you know, everything they do for me.
That was Gabby Dabrowski speaking to Heather Hiscox on CBC Morning Live. You would not expect to enjoy a creature called the ratfish, and you probably won't, but for altogether more strange and disturbing reasons than you're thinking. It would be bad if the ratfish was like a combination of rat and fish, but it's worse, and it's weirder. The ratfish looks like we were never supposed to see it, and it's mad that we have. On its forehead is a fleshy, bulbous appendage with serrated, teeth-like formations. And now good news, a new study will really expand our understanding of the tenaculum, as the fleshy bulbous appendage is called. Carly Cohen is a marine biologist at the University of Washington and the lead author on the study. We reached her in Seattle.
Carly, so we're talking about a ratfish, also known as a ghost shark. That gives us a hint of the kind of thing we might be looking at. But you've been diving and actually have seen them in the water. You've come face to face with them. Are goosebumps happening? What's happening when you come face to face?
Yeah, so ratfishes, they have so many names, right? Ratfish, chimera, ghost shark. And really, ghost shark comes from their essence of spookiness when you see them in their natural habitat. So they're these very shimmery, floating almost like fishes that have these massive eyes that kind of shine bright, almost bright green when light hits them in the deep sea. Kind of the same way that your cat's eyes might turn like green when you catch them. They've got these protein crystals in their eyes to help them see better in the dark. And they have these massive fins that help them glide. They almost move like butterfly wings. So they're kind of spooky and eerily just floating through the deep sea. So the combo there gives that kind of eerie feeling.
That sounds really beautiful. You know, you're an expert in these things, but if a layperson saw them, would it be scary, do you think? Because it sounds beautiful, what you're describing.
I think that they're beautiful. I'm not sure that they are, that they're so scary. It's not like coming up to like a massive, massive organism in the water. Right. But they are definitely certainly curious. I think the scariest thing about them has to be this really large dorsal spine that they have and their tentaculum, like these really spiky, toothy things.
Yeah.
Local fishermen will tell you that they are a pain to get out of nets.
Oh, I bet. The tentaculum is what I was going to ask you about next, because this is a, you know, everything you listed at the start of our conversation would be enough to make it an interesting creature. But that's not all. They have this tentaculum. Describe it and what it's for.
Yeah, so the tentaculum is on male ratfishes, and it's this club-shaped kind of rod sticking off of their forehead, and it's covered in rows of spiky teeth. And in the spotted ratfish, those teeth look like cat claws. So just rows and rows of these sharp, toothy-like projections. And they use it to help them mate. You know, they're swimming in the deep sea. Who knows when they're going to find a buddy? And also, it's hard to not have hands. And so the tentaculum is used to grasp onto the fins of females and help the male kind of situate himself in place so that they can mate.
It does not sound romantic.
No.
But it gets they got to do what they got to do.
It gets the job done.
Yeah.
They're one of the most abundant species here. So yeah, clearly it's working for them.
It's working. These are the only fish that have a tentaculum. Is that right?
Yeah, so ratfishes in general. So the species we looked at was the spotted ratfish, which is local here in Washington. And it's an interesting opportunity to study them. Ratfishes are sharks. They're related to sharks and rays and skates, but they're really deep sea animals. They're hard to find and they're really hard to study and come across, except these species come up shallow to mate. Mm-hmm. So it gives us this like rare glimpse into the world of a deep sea shark species. Yeah. But all of these ratfishes have some sort of, the males do at least, tentaculum on their head. But this is one of the most pronounced species.
And you wanted to take a closer look at the tentaculum as part of this new research you were working on. What specifically did you want to get at?
Yeah, so ratfishes in their many names are also called naked sharks. Which is funny considering this massive toothy structure on their head. But if we think of other species of sharks, nurse sharks and dogfish that people might have seen in an aquarium and touched in a touch tank, their backs are all sandpapery, and those are called denticles. They're tooth-like scales, and they cover all of our sharks. But ratfishes don't have any. They're silvery, they're shimmery, they're slimy. They don't have anything except this weird toothed tentaculum. And so as an evolutionary marine biologist, our questions was kind of, well, where did this tentaculum come from? It's so close to the face. Could it be another jaw? We have some really weird fossils. My collaborator, Michael Coates, brought into this project the fossil Helidus simplex, which is this amazing creature that kind of gives us a little glimpse into the past diversity of this group. But where did this tentaculum come from? Is this just denticles of sharks that is kind of aggregated in this weird structure? Is it something totally different? And so that's what we were really interested in.
And you found that they're not denticles, they are actual teeth.
No, they're totally teeth. Just like the teeth in your mouth or your cat's mouth or in the ratfish mouth. They share a very similar development. They have a structure called a dental lamina, which is like the telltale sign that you're dealing with teeth rather than denticles. And so it was this really exciting opportunity to find something that is so vertebrate. It's so core to how animals navigate ecosystems is teeth, and all of the teeth, mine, my pets, a snake fang and ratfish, they're built the same way. It's pretty incredible.
So what does all of that, Carly, suggest to you about the way animals can evolve?
I think it highlights the flexibility of something that we think is so core about vertebrates and animals. Sharks have been around for 500 million years, more than that. And they've always been covered in teeth. Our seafloor is literally littered with the teeth that have fallen off and the denticles that have fallen off of fishes and sharks past. Our molars are this incredible evolutionary tool that allowed for chewing in a really kind of efficient way. So they're really important. It's amazing that these teeth can be found in a bizarre place like the forehead of this ratfish. And so thinking about kind of the traits that unite us all, and what the world must have looked like millions of years ago and over the course of evolution. It's cool to see something that's so important, teeth, pop up in this really interesting way.
Carly, thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Carly Cohen is a marine biologist at the University of Washington and the lead author of a new study of the ratfish, which was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. She's in Seattle. It's not the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but people who live near Quill Lake, Saskatchewan, say the abandoned excavator that's been sticking out of the water for over a decade is a major landmark in its own right. At least it was, until this summer when a local crew pulled the 45,000-kilogram rig out of the water. Peter Mills, host of CBC Saskatchewan's afternoon radio show, The 306, talked to resident Janice Reynolds about losing the excavator and to Lance Lund, the man who orchestrated its removal. Here's part of their conversation.
The excavator was interesting to us because it was there for the last 10 or 11 years. In 2010 and 2011, it was very, very wet in Saskatchewan. And all of the farmers, we were getting stuck in with our equipment. And that was kind of an unusual situation because usually it's dry. So we had a whole lot of challenges with combines, tractors, sprayers, everything getting really, really stuck and sinking down to our axles. So I think when the excavator went in, that was one of the worst ones. So we all felt a little bit better about the challenges that we were facing on our farms. The excavator was both sadness that that landmark was gone and a memory of that time. And it was also kind of cool to see it come out and know that they got it out. To me, a lot of landmarks are disappearing, and we live in a flat country with not a lot of things to see. So all of those things are interesting, whether it's an old grain elevator that isn't there anymore. Those are just landmarks.
Lance, how did you get involved in this? Like, were you aware of this excavator in the lake?
Yeah, well, we do a lot of work down, like we run mud and whatnot from Estevan, Regina area. We've drove past it a few times and seen it out there for sure. What kind of brought our attention to it was seen it on TikTok there, and they were saying there was a bounty on it.
So what did you do?
Well, we put a team together. Everybody at Raptor kind of came together, and I built my own system, and we knew we had to get it up before we could get it out. It takes a lot of pulling power. When we lifted it up with the mud and whatnot that was on it with the 80-ton, it was sitting around that 100,000-pound mark. Took quite a few machines. We had an 80-ton picker, we had a 30-ton picker, two bed trucks, and my gin pull system.
So, Lance, do you feel like a hero or a villain? Like, what are you hearing from people who considered this a landmark?
Well, at the end of the day, there was still a lot of oil left in that thing. There is fish in that lake, as much as people don't believe that there is. I get where everybody's kind of mad because it's like a landmark, but at the end of the day, like, it's got to be cleaned up regardless. There was a pile of other stuff that was left out there. We cleaned everything up.
CBC Saskatchewan's Peter Mills talking to Janice Reynolds and Lance Lund.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
day I'll be free for my mind to stay. Fall asleep from the dismay. I have forgotten everything. Don't get in the way. I ain't here to stay. No, I ain't afraid.